We're going to come this evening to one of the more difficult verses for most people to swallow that are found in Romans chapter 9. Because at the end of the paragraph that started in verse 6, questioning the issue of whether Paul's theology was accurately reflecting the truth, because it seemed to his adversaries that what he was saying actually translated into a failure on God's part in terms of his promises to fathers. And his argument then became an argument based on the text of the Old Testament and the hermeneutical principles of paying attention to what's in the context and what the setting is and all that kind of thing. So in Paul's presentation of the reality of God's larger plan, and that's really chapters 9, 10, and 11, he has so far argued that the accusation that he hates the Israelites is false. He has argued that's false, and he's also argued that the accusation that his gospel is inherently self-contradictory is also false. However, his argument that the accusation that his gospel is inherently self-contradictory introduces a concept that has become, as strange as it sounds, a major stumbling block for lots and lots of people who profess faith in Christ. And that stumbling block boils down to this: whether God has a right to make decisions that affect others for good or ill. That's the bottom line. Can God legitimately make decisions that affect other people for good or ill? Does he have that right? And of course, that question raises the reality of one of the most crucial issues in everybody's experience, and that is, how does any given realization of reality affect this reaction in regard to God? Unbelievers, at the heart of whether or not they remain unbelievers, often react to the idea that what verse 13 says, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated, on the heels of the idea in verse 11 that God is working things according to purpose, and the purpose is according to election. It's the according to election purpose. And then the statement that Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated, seems to paint God in a kind of way in their minds that they said, well, I don't want anything to do with a God like that. And on the other hand, for believers, because unbelievers are the ones who react most violently to the notion that God has their well-being in the palm of his hands, whether they like it or not, and that he has a right to make decisions regarding them because he's God and they're not, that really creates a tremendous amount of rejection on their part, because one of man's most fundamental depravity issues is, I want to be in control of my life, period. Well, believers haven't divested themselves of that either, and for many believers, this is at the heart of whether or not they continue to progress in sanctification, or they take their hand off the plow. I mean, Luke 9:62 talks about, if you start plowing and then you take your hand off the plow, then you're proving that you're not really worthy of the whole issue of where the plowing is supposed to take you. So the issue of reaction is typically found in one of two situations. First, reality consists of being subjected to some experience, whether it's considered good or bad. And second, reality consists in discovering something about God that is previously unknown, whether it's determined to be good or bad. So what we're actually facing is Paul's claim that his gospel is inherently consistent because God's God and we're not, and he has the right to make decisions that affect us. And the issue there is that what happens when God subjects someone to an unexpected experience, there are two things in play. One of them is whether they like the experience or they don't, and whether God is the one who caused it or not. So when God subjects us to something that's unexpected, a lot of times we don't like what's happened, and so we immediately blame God for it. God, why'd you let this happen? And so on. But on the other hand, there's also the reality of the revelation that it gives about God. And when we're subjected to certain things, he's revealing himself in some kind of ways. And he's revealing something that they didn't previously know or think about. This is the classic situation, John chapter 6, where Jesus takes on this whole issue of whether people ought to have a right to be self-determining, autonomous in the creation of a God who's not really able to even create autonomous creatures. It's impossible for God to create autonomous creatures, because that allows them to be gods, and they're not. They're not qualified, and they can't function that way, and he can't create God. So what's going on there is that when Jesus was dealing with that in John 6, he said some things that irritated deeply some of his disciples, and it says they walked no more with him. And the reason is because they had just been told something about God that they hadn't considered and didn't like. So that's really what the issues are. And so the answers to the reaction issue are critical, because the reactions themselves and the answers become determinative agents about whether or not we're going to continue to progress in our own growth in the truth. I mean, Job ran into this. Job didn't know the big story behind the experiences that he was facing. I'm not sure he would have liked it, even if he had. Even if you argue that in the book of Job, Satan was behind the disasters that happened to Job, you still have the age-old argument, well, God's bigger than the devil, so he could have kept it from happening if he wanted to. And Job says he didn't want to. He said he gave him permission. So you still have this onus that comes back on God as being some kind of a manipulative something or other. And Job fell into that trap. He never cursed God. He never denied him. But he argued vehemently that he shouldn't have been being treated this way. And he went on and on and on and on and on. And so did, I mean, his so-called friends. Didn't help him a bit. But after a lot of that happened, God said, okay, Job, I want to ask you some questions. And I think it was Ravi Zacharias that said he asked him 68 questions. He couldn't answer any of them. And so he finally decided, I better shut my mouth. And in the final analysis, of course, God responded to his willingness to endure for the sake of God's truth and so forth, even if he had all these questions and complaints. And so he restored him, and James says in chapter 5, everybody needs to consider Job, how the outcome of his faith was to his advantage. But this is where we run into this conundrum of creatures trying to render judgment against God when they're ignorant and he's not. And he's powerful and they're not. So when we go into this verse 13, just as it stands written, we need to understand that it is a text that is problematical for many, many human beings, given the fall, given our depravity, given our penchant for jumping to the wrong conclusions and taking offense at things that we don't like or whatever. So, for our study this evening, we're going to look at this Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated, and see that it actually falls into its place as proof of his claim, a false claim that Yahweh has in Israel within the nation of Israelites that are heirs of the promises made to the fathers, because he's already argued that there is an Israel that are the children of promise and there are Israelites that are simply children of the flesh. That's been part of his argument down through this. Now, there are, I think, certain precursors to understanding of this statement. Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated, and it stands written kind of formula. There are a couple or three things or so that we need to be clearly aware of. One of them is that reality exists as it is. Bad theology often screeches against reality, but the screeching really doesn't change anything except the noise level and the screecher's own downward spiral into the very thing against which he's screeching. His screeching is based on, I mean, in bad theology, when he doesn't like something that's reality, I mean, you can screech, but it's reality. If you complain about that, you're only proving that you deserve what's happening to you, because you're screeching against the activity of God in your case without understanding. And that's a characteristic of depravity, not godliness. And so really, the screeching is, as I said, it raises the noise level and it creates a greater downward spiral for the person that's involved. But that's what bad theology always does. It ends up blaming God for something that causes a lack of faith in the blamer. On the other hand, good theology faces the facts of reality and then seeks a kind of understanding that continues to allow faith, hope, and love, these three, to continue to develop in the person who's experiencing this negative reality that doesn't like, that didn't ask for, didn't volunteer for, but is in the midst of it. So that's one thing we need to understand. You can't change reality by complaining about it. It isn't going to happen. Reality is, and according to the theology of the scriptures, there is a good foundation in all that God is doing, and he has promised to work everything out together for good for those who love him, so there's really no basis for any kind of complaint. That's good theology. You just seek to understand so that you can continue to grow in faith, hope, and love. But the most basic issue, and this is the second one of these precursor things, is that God has the right to make decisions that affect others, both for good and ill, and it's a right that all rational creatures possess and exercise day in and day out. People all day, every day, are making decisions that affect more than just themselves, and sometimes the effect is for grave evil, and it doesn't bother them that they've made this decision that's inflicting evil or pain or suffering or something else on somebody else. It doesn't bother them a bit, because they're not the ones that are suffering. They've just decided, I'm going to do this thing that I want to do, and if somebody gets hurt, that's their problem. And they go on and make their decisions. And this goes on day in and day out, all day long, every day. If creatures have the ability to make decisions that affect others for good or ill, then obviously God has the same right, because he's infinitely above their status, and so he should have the right to make decisions too. That's the most basic issue. Is God God, or am I God so I can tell him how he has to act? And then thirdly, the declaration that God made that he hated Esau does not at all mean that he didn't love Esau. We have to get this clear. It's not clear in most people's minds. Normally, I hate you doesn't mean, but I love you too. But when God says it, it's true. For multiple reasons. Number one, God told us we had to love our enemies, so what's good for the what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. You got to do it yourself, God, if you're going to tell us we have to do it, if it's in harmony with godliness. So if I have to love my enemies, he's got to love his. That means he loves his enemies. But as we've said many, many, many times, all love and hate issues in all of life's setting, and especially in scriptures, are highly situational. I'm not talking about situation ethics here. I'm just talking about the fact that love and hate are applied or not based on certain situations, and the inherent complexity is created by the fact that there is a creation in which there are multiple people, persons, involved. It's never just one-on-one. When God says, love your enemies, the word's plural, but it may mean that you only have one enemy, but your responsibility is to love him. But what does that mean in terms of your responsibility also to love your friends and to love God? So there's this complexity that's created by the fact that love is always having to make decisions, and many times the decision is, who am I going to love most? If I have to love my enemy, but I also have to love my friend, then the question that I have to face, if there comes a tension between the enemy and the friend's well-being, which one am I going to strive to encourage for good, and which one am I going to sacrifice? John 3:16 says that in the love of God, he sacrificed his son for the sake of his adversaries. But typically in the scriptures, he never asks us to do that. He didn't tell me that I have to love my enemy so that I can let my enemy do whatever that enemy wants to do to somebody else that I do love. That's the conundrum. And you have imperatives in scripture that insist that you act in a hateful way toward one individual or set of individuals in order to spare another individual or set of individuals. And that's the root of all capital punishment in the scriptures. the society is called upon by God and given orders by God to punish the evildoers in order to protect the doer of good. So God doesn't say hate your enemies and don't prosecute them for their crimes. He says love your enemies, but prosecute them for their crimes because you're also loving your friend or whatever. So this is where the complication gets involved, because if it were a one-on-one universe, God would love his enemy and he would fight himself for that enemy. But it's not that. It's never been that. There's never been a time in the infinity of God where there's only been two people involved. There's always been at least three. The Spirit, the Son, and the Father. So there's never been a singularly uncomplex setting for love. That means then that the bottom line in all love statements is a fact of willingness to sacrifice something else that's loved for the sake of the ultimately loved. And if it were one-on-one, my love for my enemy would mean I would sacrifice myself because I love myself, but I love my enemy more. But in the reality, I have to choose not only between whether I'm going to sacrifice myself, but whether I'm going to sacrifice this person and this person and this person and this person, because my enemy wants to do damage to all of them as well as me. And the scriptures are pretty clear that you don't do that. You don't sacrifice these people for your enemy's sake. You may be willing to sacrifice yourself for them, but you're not granted the right to sacrifice these other people. So in all the love statements, there is this fact that you have to be willing to sacrifice yourself, but you also have to protect the more beloved, the ultimately loved. And you could even make an argument that God sacrificed his Son because of his love for the world, but in the process, he actually enhanced his Son's status and all that, because he raised him from the dead, made him head above all things, gave him a name above every name, gave him a bride from among humanity, did all these things because his Son was willing to be obedient to him even unto death. So in that regard, his love for the world was actually eventually trumped by his love for his own Son. So it gets complex. But the same thing's true in the bottom line of all hate statements. Because all hate statements simply express an unwillingness to sacrifice something that's loved for something that's hated. I can love my enemy if I'm willing to sacrifice myself for him, but I can hate my enemy if I'm unwilling to sacrifice this person, that person, for his sake. It's perfectly legitimate. God even does that. He executes the vengeance on the wicked for their treatment of his beloved. So it's the complexity. It exists. And it exists because in every particular point in time situation, there are multiple objects that can either be loved or hated, but not both, at least at the same time. Always. There are always more objects of love or hate than one or two. So, the love of God has been made exceedingly clear in that every situation where there is only God and one object, God will sacrifice himself for the sake of the beloved. That's John 3:16. God was the loser when he sacrificed his Son on Calvary, because the rupture that occurred between him and his Son was not just the Son's pain. It was the Father's too. And he did that for our sake, the world, the rebels in their depravity. He did it to make it possible for us to be redeemed and brought into a new status as his children and forgiven and qualified for glory. If it's one-on-one, God will sacrifice himself. In John 3:16, it's the Son versus the world, and he chooses the world over his Son, at least in a temporary kind of setting. But in the reality of the universe, the one-on-one never exists. So in a conflict-filled universe, where there are multiple objects of love, choices have to be made. Choices have to be made. And those choices are inevitably going to affect some people for good and some for not. In the case of the Jacob and Esau setting, there was only one who could inherit the mantle of the promises as the progenitor of the seed. There was only one who could be given the priority or prerogative of the firstborn. God had promised the seed to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But in the case of the promise to Isaac and Rebekah that the seed's coming. As soon as Rebekah's got two babies in her womb, one of them's going to be chosen and the other's going to be rejected in light of that issue, the progenitor of the seed. And that includes the birthright thing. So it was told to Rebekah ahead of time what God's decision in that situation was going to be. He was going to take the weaker and he was going to make the stronger slave to the weaker. He said that. That's what it's going to be. Before the whole issue of, well, why did you make that choice, God? Was this person better than that person, or was this person worse than that person? And Paul says, that's not the issue at all. If we're going to stay away from the doing of good and doing of evil, and this is the reason why God does what he does with people, he said, if we get into that, we're going to get into judicial issues that will condemn all humanity. There will be no redemption. If we're going to go on doing good and doing evil, there's no hope for anybody. So God, unwilling to accept that, says, okay, we're going to go on the basis of grace. And on the basis of grace, nobody deserves anything, but I'm going to give some what they don't deserve, and I'm going to not give the others what they don't deserve either. I'm not going to give them something they don't deserve, because somebody's got to make this decision. Is Jacob going to be the one who inherits the birthright and the promise, or is Esau going to be? And who's supposed to make that decision, and why? If we left it up to Isaac and Rebekah, we already know what would happen. Isaac would choose Esau and Rebekah would choose Jacob. That's the way it worked. So if you leave it up to them, you're going to have chaos and conflict. So who should we leave it up to? Well, if we leave it up to Esau, guess who's going to be the one? Or if we leave it up to Jacob, who's going to be the one? And all these choices are going to be selfish choices. They just have to do with what I get out of it. And God says, on the basis of that whole scenario, I'm going to make the decision. And I'm telling you, I'm going to favor the weaker over the stronger. Now, that means then that on the heels of that decision, that both Isaac and Rebekah had choices to make in respect to the decision that was declared. So when Esau was born, and they named him Esau, and he was hale and hearty, and, you know, and then out comes his brother with his fingers and thumb pinching on his brother's heel. They name him, according to that, Jacob, supplanter. But there's this underlying sense that they name him supplanter because they know that's God's choice. He's going to supplant his older brother in terms of the olderness business, but he's seconds older. The real issue, I believe, is the strength and vitality of Esau as a hunter and a he-man and the guy that his father dotes on because he's strong and all that. And his brother apparently is weaker and more dependent, and mom, in her natural nurturing mode, is going to go for the weaker one, and that's what she does. Both Isaac and Rebekah do what is natural and fleshly. But Isaac and Rebekah both have to respond to what God has said is going to be, and Isaac does not do a good job with that, and I'm not sure Rebekah did either. But at least she did settle on the one that God had said was going to be the heir of the promises and so forth. And they all apparently knew that it had something to do with the birthright. And you know the story. Jacob was at home and he was making soup and, he was the homeboy and the mama's boy and involved in the culinary things, the women's work and all that nonsense. But his brother was out there hunting, and he was killing the game and all that kind of stuff. But he comes in after a futile effort, and he's famished, and there's this cauldron of delicious smelling stuff cooking, and he says, "Give me some of that." And his brother says, "That's mine. You can't just come in and take it. If you want some, you're going to have to trade me for it." "What do you want?" "I want your birthright." "Well, what good is that going to do me if I starve to death? You're going to get it anyway, so give me some of that and you can have the birthright." That attitude is an expression of the developing depravity of Esau, and the book of Hebrews, I think it is, says that he was a profane man because he despised the birthright for his belly's sake. So what has that got to do with this Jacob I loved and Esau hated in light of these realities? Well, God deliberately chose to exalt the weaker over the stronger, and those involved had to react to that. And Esau was hated in that sense of diminishing his value as fitting this setting. The setting was, I got to produce a seed. Okay, somebody's going to have to be the one that produces this seed. And so I'm going to value this one, make him the one who's going to produce it. I'm going to give him the status of that. And I'm going to demean the other by devaluing him. And that's all what love and hate is. Love exalts in value and hate diminishes in value. In a setting. Well, God's dealings with Jacob and Esau in that setting created reactions. That's what we started this whole thing about. What do you do in reacting to what God has decided or revealed or done? You can't change reality. You can't fight God and win. So how are you going to react to this? Well, Esau reacted, and he proved that his reaction was selfish ungodliness, and it devolved into antagonism against God for not choosing him. And that antagonism created an ever-deepening hatred on God's part for him. In other words, God's reacting to his hatred with hatred of his own, in a sense of God responding to Esau's reaction to his choice that Jacob was going to be the one to whom Esau would have to render service. So it worked that way. Esau's hatred for God was rooted entirely on the fact that he wanted to have the birthright. He wanted to be the exalted one. There's nothing godly about those motivations. It's perfectly selfish. And therefore, this whole thing began to play out. And the reason I talk about it playing out is because this quote in verse 13 is found in Malachi. It's found in Malachi. Well, Malachi was a prophet just before the period of silence between the Testaments. Malachi was the last Old Testament prophet. It was 400, perhaps 450 years, perhaps a few more, before John the Baptizer came on the scene. Malachi was the last Old Testament prophet. Malachi was 1,000 years after the statement was made to Rebekah. So why is Paul quoting a declaration that God made 1,500 years after the historical events transpired where his choice of Jacob resulted in certain reactions by Jacob and Esau and Rebekah and Isaac? Why is he quoting this 1,500 years down the road? Why didn't he just go back to the text there in Genesis and find something to support his argument? Well, there's one of two things you could say about it. One of them is you can say, well, God's just a sovereign God, and he's got a right to make a choice, and he made his choice and lived with it. And, of course, that kind of reaction is what most people react to. They don't like that take-it-or-leave-it kind of mindset. But why don't they like it? Typically, they don't like it because they're scared to death that they're going to get the same kind of treatment from God. And they won't like it any better than Esau liked it. But the question is, why do you not like it? Well, I don't get what I want. That's the bottom line. I mean, if you're going to measure genuine godliness by any standard that comes anywhere close to the biblical, you're going to have to go to Christ and his willingness to submit to his Father and love his church to the point of the death of the cross, which was the suffering of eternal Gehenna in the setting of the legacy of sin by millions and billions of people. He was going to endure everything justice had stored up for sinners in the world for all time. He was going to pay that in full by his own suffering. And then, from that one, you're going to have to go to the Apostle Paul, who starts this whole thing out by declaring that if it would be possible, he would offer himself as an eternal sacrifice, Gehenna sacrifice, for the sake of his adversaries, the Israelites. So that's the standard that you have to start measuring things by And if godliness is actually the willingness to suffer eternal death for the sake of your enemies, if that's the standard, then you apply that standard to Esau. And he wasn't willing. So he had to be ungodly. And his subsequent behavior proved it. His ungodliness developed out of his antagonism that started in his being subjected to a choice that God made that he didn't like. That's basically what it boiled down to. What would have happened if, on the other hand, Esau had said, well, you know, this is God's choice. If he wants my brother to be the one, then that's okay with me. He wouldn't have had this antagonism toward God. He wouldn't have had this antagonism toward his brother. His brother wouldn't have to worry about whether he's going to kill him or not. There wouldn't be all this conflict in the household. But that's not the decision he made. And that's Paul's whole point in the verse 11, where he says, in effect, God took this whole thing out of the performance arena. You cannot have grace in a performance arena. If it's in the performance arena, you've got to give the person what they deserve. If you've got to give them what they deserve, you've got to give Jacob the same condemnation that you're going to give Esau for the same level of depravity, because they're both sinful human beings. And then you're going to have to spank Isaac and Rebekah for their behavior too, if you're going to put it in the performance arena. So in order to get out of the necessity of destroying everybody, God just moves it up to the level of grace and says, okay, in my son, I will deal with justice. But in reality, passed on the basis of my son's efficient fulfillment of justice, I'm free to be gracious, and I'm choosing who I'm going to be gracious to. And in this case, I'm going to exalt the weaker over the stronger. So in a very real sense, I think that what's going on in Malachi 1:21, where God says, look at it. He says, in Malachi 1, he says to Israel, I have loved you. And they say, whoa, where have you loved us? And then he goes into his explanation. And in the statement, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, has been proven in history. Esau ends up being the recipient of a hardened hatred on God's part, where vengeance is settled upon him. If you look in Malachi, the text of Malachi is the final development over 1,000 years of the development of Esau's hatred for God as the progenitor of a nation of people who hated God. And it actually proved Paul's ultimate point, because in Malachi it says, God says, Esau says, I'm gonna overcome what God has done to me. I'm gonna build where he's destroyed. God says, let him build, I'm going to destroy it again. Because he's reacting to this ungodliness. And it only proves the point. Paul's ultimate point in this whole paragraph is that the gospel of the grace of God is all about God taking the initiative, make promises, and maintain his integrity for the sake of those who are the children of the promise. This is God's gospel of grace. It's his initiative, he takes it, he makes people his children by taking initiative with them. And the rationale for this grace is extraordinarily clear, made obvious in Romans 4:16, because this is the only way God's integrity can stand. It's the only way God's integrity can stand. If God makes a promise, he has to be the one who keeps it, because if he puts the keeping of it on anybody else's shoulders and they fail, his integrity is what's lost. So they won't do it. So when he makes a promise, he keeps it, and the way he keeps it is he makes the decisions that will make sure that it comes to pass. So that's the rationale for grace. And Paul's point is that the Israelites can be and have been permitted by God to do the same thing God does, and that is make decisions that affect other people. The problem with that is that they're making self-centered decisions, and they're reacting to God in their God undergirded experiences that they don't like, and their God illumined knowledge of him so that they don't like it. And in that reaction, God did, in fact, the very thing that the Israelites are crying against in opposition to Paul's message. He didn't compel their submission. and thus guarantee their salvation as the fleshly seed. He just didn't do it. He said, I'm going to do this for Jacob, and I'm going to refrain from doing this for Esau. And Esau took that badly. And then his entire offspring kept taking it badly for the next 1,000 or 1,500 years. Abraham was 2,000 years after Adam. And Christ is basically 2,000 years after Abraham. And the law was given 450 years after the promises were given. So that's about 1,500 years B.C. And that's about the time Isaac and Jacob and all. So that's 1,500 years. Let's give or take a few. But the point is, God also did, in fact, enforce his integrity regarding his promises. He had said, this is the way it's going to be, and in order for his integrity to stand, that's the way it had to be. So he made whatever choices he had to make sure that that's the way it would be, because his integrity is the undergirding, sustaining support for our confidence in him. If his integrity is of no real substance, then we have nothing to believe. And without faith, there's no hope. And without hope, life is hopeless. It becomes hell in a very real sense, emotionally and spiritually, before we ever even get there. Because there's this hopelessness that's camped on top of us. So God has to maintain his integrity in order for us to have life. So he enforced his integrity. He made the promises, undergird them, made sure they happened. And the overall point is that the love that comes out of grace is not a doctrine of the love that comes out of law. It's not a doctrine that's embraced by those who value their freedom of choice. But it is a doctrine of divine intervention to the point of submission for those who are Israel, that is, as different from Israelites. And those who are the church, as respects Paul's preaching to the Gentiles. His argument is, my theology is consistent because my theology says the word of God does stand, it doesn't fail, because God restricts the behavior of his creatures so that they cannot undercut his integrity. And this is proven in his statement, Jacob I have loved and Esau I've hated. And that makes it possible for us to believe in the grace of God and his willingness to be all that the gospel says he is. And the apostles told the people of Israel, the Israelites, the promises are for you and for your children. It was necessary to preach this to you first, but seeing that you decide that you're not worthy of eternal life, I'm going to go preach it to some other people that might, on the other hand, believe it. So that's the way it sits. It sits in the thing. But the point that he is making is fundamental. God made certain promises that had to be kept. The keeping of them required certain decisions. He made them. It's his prerogative as God. So, I think that's what the verse is actually saying.